Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star and then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Candace, for welcoming people, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop update on pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors. Now, today's program is a collaborative effort between many cancer organizations, as well as the Cure Pancreatic Cancer Lustgarten Foundation, Hirschberg Foundation for Pancreatic Cancer Research, and PanCAN, Pancreatic Cancer Action Network. And it's because of that collaboration and all of your interest in this program and all of our other organizations that cancer organizations that helped us spread the word about this program, we have over 391 participants on the call today. This is a very large call, and we have participants from all over the United States. And we also have international participants from Argentina, Canada, Costa Rica, Philippines, Turkey, and the United Kingdom. So it's really a credit to each of you that you have chosen to spend the next hour with us on this program. Now, today's program was made possible by Novartis Oncology and Pfizer, and I really want to thank them for their support of the program and for their corporate partnership in making this program possible. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Eileen O'Reilly, and Dr. O'Reilly is Associate Director, Clinical Research, David M. Rubenstein Center for Pancreatic Cancer Research, Attending Physician, Member, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, Professor of Medicine, Weill Cornell Medical College. Dr. O'Reilly is going to present an overview of pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors. Should discuss diagnosis and staging and treatment options, including targeted therapies. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. O'Reilly.
So good afternoon, everybody. Greetings from New York, and thank you, Carolyn, for the introduction. It's a real pleasure to be here today to walk us through pancreas neuroendocrine cancers. And I just want to start by introducing the fact that pancreas cancers are a broad group of malignancies. And when people refer to the term pancreas cancer, we usually think of something called adenocarcinoma. But we're actually not talking about that today. We're talking about a much less common entity. It's about 1 to 2% of all pancreas malignancies, and that's neuroendocrine cancers, which originate in the pancreas. So neuroendocrine cancers as a group can arise anywhere in the body. Common sites include the small bowel, the appendix, the stomach, the pancreas, and the lung. And these cancers have a distinct behavior and different treatment options and different outcomes to typical pancreas cancer. So one of the things that's been observed over the last couple of decades is that we're diagnosing pancreas neuroendocrine cancers, or PNETs as they're often called, more frequently. And it's not so clear why this is happening. It may be a true increase in incidence, but it's also thought that it relates to diagnostic imaging and picking up these malignancies somewhat incidentally for some patients. And that's led to a slow but steady increase over about 20 years now in this type of cancer. These cancers are broken down into a number of different types. We think about whether or not they produce certain types of hormones. They're called functional tumors. That's about a third of pancreas neuroendocrine cancers. And about two-thirds don't produce hormones that we routinely measure. And perhaps some of you are aware that the hormones that can be produced can be insulin. That's rare, but that can cause people to develop very low blood sugar and can have a very classic but difficult to diagnose presentation. Sometimes can produce hormones that can cause diarrhea or can lead to an excess of ulcers in the duodenum and the small bowel over time. When, as an oncologist, we're thinking about these cancers, there's a couple of important things that we want to know. We want to know how this looks down the microscope, what the differentiation of the tumor is like. That means how like normal cells versus unlike normal cells it looks. whether there are a lot of cells that are turning over in the active phase of cell division, and that speaks to something called a mitosis, or also called a Ki-67, and that gives us a sense of what the behavior over time of these types of malignancies can be. And we also look at the differentiation of the tumor, and we look where at presentation the cancer involves, whether it's just in the pancreas or whether it's gone to the liver, which is the most common site of metastasis, or whether it's in the abdominal cavity and less rarely, less commonly in the lungs or the bones. But these malignancies can go to a number of different sites. In terms of risk factors for these classes of diseases, they're not so well known, and in that for most patients they are sporadic, meaning we don't understand and there isn't an obvious predisposition in the family. Very rarely there can be syndromes that can run in families that can connect pancreas neuroendocrine cancers with some other endocrine malignancies that can arise in the thyroid, in the parathyroid, it's a little gland beside the thyroid, and in the adrenal gland and other places in the body. And when we see or hear that there's other malignancies in the family, we're always thinking whether there could be a familial connection, because that has implications for healthy family members. But in truth, that's a small number of people with this disease. So moving to the presentation, sometimes these cancers are picked up incidentally. People have imaging for another reason and identified to have it, or they're being followed for another cancer and identified to have it. Sometimes patients will develop symptoms, and they can include the symptoms related to the excess of hormone production, or they can be symptoms related to tumor bulk, for example, discomfort in the liver area, decrease in appetite, weight loss, if there's a lot of disease going on. And I mentioned at the beginning that the differentiation of these tumors is important. So sometimes people can have a lot of cancer present but look and feel very well, and they are usually very well differentiated, very slow growing tumors, and they have often been there for a long period of time in the body. In contrast, sometimes when the cancer is behaving more actively, that's often when symptoms are a greater part of the initial presentation for the disease. When we're staging these cancers, the main tools that we use are a CT, a high-quality CT. You have to give the contrast carefully to delineate the disease, particularly in the pancreas itself and in the liver. An MRI is a complementary test, and then unique to this type of cancer is something called somatostatin receptor scintigraphy, or people will perhaps know the term Octrea scan, which is used to identify certain proteins on the surface of these tumors that can be used to determine whether a form of treatment, a hormonal form of treatment, would be helpful for this disease. So we use it both as a diagnostic and as an identification for treatment. PET scans are used. That's where we give a glucose label, which can rotate around the body, and higher grade, more active tumors tend to take up PET tracers more, so they are often used to identify the full extent of the disease. So moving to the treatment aspects of neuroendocrine cancers of the pancreas, and several things matter. It depends what the extent of the disease, it depends what the extent of symptoms that a given person might have, and of course it depends on the particular person's medical well-being and any relevant background factors. For tumors that are localized to the pancreas, the recommendation is surgical removal. For most patients where the cancer has spread, it's usually not possible to remove all the disease, although occasionally we will do that as a debulking approach, particularly if there's relatively limited disease in the liver, for example, or if somebody was having discomfort or pressure on the bile ducts in the liver from bulky metastasis there. Occasionally surgical intervention can be appropriate. But for the most part, when this cancer has spread, it's non-operative management. And the major classes of approaches to treatment would include what's called regional-directed therapies. They're therapies directed to the liver in particular. And then systemic therapies are treatments that circulate around and affect the cancer wherever it might be. So for a minute, in terms of liver-directed therapies, and these are used, I would say, very widely, and they can include an embolization-based approach where a little catheter is passed into the groin and up into one of the major arteries that supplies these tumors in the liver. And the idea is you shut off the blood supply with little particles that are injected into the artery, and that causes these tumors to shrink and the cells to die to a degree. And that can be very helpful for providing control of the cancer over a period of time. This approach certainly has side effects and can be some discomfort related to the intervention, and sometimes fevers, infection, and rarely other things related to this type of approach. So moving to the medical treatments for pancreas neuroendocrine cancer, and we're fortunate in 2016 to have a number of drugs available to treat this cancer, and about 5 years ago we had two in particular that were FDA approved, and there was, I think, a lot of excitement around this and really has engaged the clinical and research community in terms of pancreas neuroendocrine cancer, recognizing that there are new directions in terms of treatment. And more recently we have some additional approaches which build on a hormonal approach such as standostatin. So starting with the hormonal approaches, this is something that we'll use commonly for people who have uptake on this octreotide type scan, where we give a hormonal treatment which can stop the cancer growing. It can shut down hormonal production. It can reduce symptoms. And for many patients, we continue these types of medications for long periods of time. In North America, we have two of these drugs. One is a drug called sandostatin, LAR, which is given as a monthly deep injection into the buttock, and a more recent drug called lanreotide, which is given as a subcutaneous injection that sometimes patients and families will learn how to self-administer themselves. So these drugs have been a very important addition to the range of treatments. And other drugs, and these are more in the context of targeted medications, include a drug called everolimus. It's called an mTOR inhibitor. That's a class of drugs. And this has been shown to slow the growth of pancreas neuroendocrine cancers over time. Relatively well-tolerated medications taken on a continuous daily basis. Some fatigue, sometimes some soreness in the mouth. Rarely some irritation in the lungs, and sometimes an increase in the blood sugar would be common side effects. And another FDA-approved medication is a drug called sunitinib, which affects a different class of pathways that are involved in growth and development and metastasis of these type of malignancies. In particular, it affects blood vessel-related pathways, and there are several other related drugs that are in clinical trials and other combinations for the treatment of pancreas neuroendocrine cancer. And I also just want to make another important point, that for patients with this disease who, as we mentioned, can sometimes have a lot of disease present but can thankfully look and feel very well and be active in going about their daily life, sometimes there isn't a need to start medication initially. And for many patients, we watch carefully but over extended periods of time until either it's clear that the disease is growing or that symptoms are intervening, and those characteristics can be the criteria that would recommend treatment getting started. So it's not always that we need to do something and do something now in this disease, and watchful waiting or expectant management, I think, is a very important strategy that can buy time off treatment and hence time away from side effects for a lot of people for extended periods of time. So for the last minute or two, I just want to bring up one other important emerging area, and Dr. Dasari will follow on this in a few minutes. And just going back to this topic of there being receptors or proteins on the surface of neuroendocrine cancers where we use a hormonal medication to bind that. These days, and our colleagues in Europe have been ahead of us for many years here, but we can add a radiation tag or label to this somatostatin drug and give that intravenously, and that's a way of providing a very targeted approach. And this approach is called peptide receptor radionuclide therapy, or PRRT, and it's beginning to be investigated, I would say now, quite extensively in North America. And of particular note, we've had some data in a related type of neuroendocrine cancer, primarily originating in the small bowel, where this was shown to have a significant impact on the growth rate of the cancer. The full maturity of the results from the trial aren't available yet, but the signal, I think, is very promising. There are some side effects with this approach, and that can include blood count suppression in terms of the white cells, but more particularly anemia and platelets. And sometimes there can be kidney injury and other issues that can arise. So we're learning what's the best type of label to use and how to dose and what frequency this type of treatment would most benefit patients. So stepping back and just summing up here, for neuroendocrine cancers, diverse group of disease, but pancreas neuroendocrine cancer, relatively uncommon, but increasing in incidence. As you've gathered, there are a lot of different approaches to treatment, and many groups of physicians as part of a team are involved in looking after people with these malignancies, include gastroenterologists, surgeons, medical oncologists, interventional radiologists, and all of our supportive care colleagues that will also speak in a few minutes. And one of the, I would say, the discussions and sometimes the dilemma is what's the right initial step for treatment, and should it be a hormonal approach, should it be an oral medication approach, or should we be doing a regional approach in terms of a liver-directed therapy, or should we be considering surgery? So this is perhaps a disease where we have a lot of discussion with our colleagues in order to optimize what might be the best choice for a particular person at a particular time in their disease course. So thank you. I'll stop there and pass the line back to Carolyn.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. O'Reilly, for just an exceptionally excellent overview of this of neuroendocrine pancreatic tumors. And our next speaker is Dr. Arvind Dasari. Dr. Dasari is Assistant Professor, Department of Gastrointestinal Medical Oncology, Division of Cancer Medicine, the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Dr. Dasari is going to address tips to manage treatment side effects, clinical trials, and key questions to ask your healthcare team about quality of life concerns. And it's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Dasari.
Thank you, Carolyn, for that introduction, and hello, everybody. So as Carolyn mentioned, I'm going to start off by talking about potential side effects from treatment for pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors. As Dr. O'Reilly discussed, the main drugs that are typically used to treat pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors are the two shots, lanreotide or octreotide, and targeted therapies, including everolimus, sunitinib, and rarely chemotherapy. So starting with lanreotide and octreotide, these are shots that are typically given once a month. And while lanreotide is given beneath the skin, octreotide is given all the way into the muscle, typically in the buttock region. Overall, these shots are very, very well tolerated. In a large trial that compared lanreotide to a placebo, it seems like it was as well tolerated as a placebo. Rarely, patients may have some mild symptoms, and these could include symptoms of mild diarrhea, flatulence. Rarely, they may develop gallstones and discomfort at the site of the injection of the shot. But regards to the symptoms of diarrhea and flatulence, this is thought to be because of the shots interfering with enzyme production of the pancreas to digest food, and this can be easily fixed with some pancreatic enzyme supplements. In terms of other drugs that are used and the potential side effects, there are many common side effects to these drugs, and the side effects are typically seen in areas of the body where the cells are proliferating or multiplying quickly, because the way most of these drugs work are eventually by preventing the cancer cells from multiplying. So their side effects are also because of kind of their effects on normal cells and preventing them from multiplying. So the side effects that we typically see are in areas where the cells are multiplying quickly. So this is typically the intestinal tract, skin, and bone marrow. In the intestinal tract, the typical symptoms could be mouth ulcers, diarrhea, nausea, vomiting. In the skin, it could be hair thinning, hair loss, rash, dry skin. In the bone marrow could be low blood count, so that is low white cell count, low platelets, low hemoglobin. Or sometimes these could cause a general symptom such as fatigue, anorexia, loss of taste and appetite. And each of these agents also have some particular side effects unique to the way they work. Before I go any further, I just want to mention that when I go over all these side effects, it'll seem like these are terrible medications and terrible drugs, but these are things that you need to watch out for, not necessarily that you would experience or develop. These are kind of information for you to know so that you can discuss with your physicians to adjust doses if needed. So the unique side effects of each drug, so starting with everolimus, one of the chemo pills. Everolimus works, as Dr. O'Reilly mentioned, by working on a protein called mTOR, and mTOR is a protein that is important for metabolism in the cell and influences how the body processes cholesterol and sugar. So there could be alterations in blood cholesterol and sugar levels in patients on this drug. And rarely, it could cause some inflammation in the lung presenting as cough. Sunitinib, again, another chemo pill. Sunitinib interferes with growth signals within the tumor cells that are important for the cells to grow and for the tumors to develop new blood vessels. So its side effects are on the blood vessels. It could cause a high blood pressure. And it can also cause some skin issues, a unique skin issue called hand-foot syndrome. Rarely, pancreatic neuroendocrine tumor patients are also treated with chemotherapy, such as capecitabine and temozolomide. And these also cause most of the side effects that we discussed that were common for these drugs. This could also cause hand-foot syndrome like sunitinib. In terms of how to manage these side effects, we'll go over the more common ones in some detail. With regards to the skin side effects, I think the key would be to take good care of your skin, so keep it well moisturized, avoid strong chemicals, and avoid direct exposure to sunlight. And if you develop itching or a severe rash or blisters or peeling, and you should let your team know immediately. And for relief, you could consider using some over-the-counter medications like Benadryl or a bath with a mild soap. Sometimes could be very relieving as well after consultation with your team. Mouth ulcers, I think the key again is kind of good mouth care. Do not wait for mouth ulcers to develop. Consider rinsing out your mouth about 3 to 4 times a day with a dilute solution of baking soda. Try to avoid any strong mouthwashes that may have alcohol. Try to avoid spicy food or foods at extreme temperatures. With regards to diarrhea, if you have fever or severe diarrhea, I think you need to let your doctors know immediately. Try to stay well hydrated, and you could also consider using antidiarrheal medications such as loperamide or Imodium. And if at any point you're getting dehydrated or have fevers or other concerning symptoms, again, you should seek medical attention immediately. with regards to nausea, vomiting, and or appetite loss, I mean, your team will typically give you medications to help relieve nausea. Both for nausea, vomiting, or diarrhea, these symptoms are best treated and addressed early on rather than when they get really severe. So again, try to stay well hydrated, take your nausea medications if and when the symptoms develop. And if you have severe nausea or vomiting, call your team immediately. With regards to appetite loss, I think try eating several small meals or snacks throughout the day. Concentrate on foods that are rich in nutrition and calories. And you can also ask for a consultation with a nutritionist as required. Moving on to low blood counts. In the blood, there are three different kinds of cells. The white cell count, which fights infection. So while on treatments, your chance of getting an infection may increase. So avoid contact with patients who have overt signs of infection. And if you do develop fever, typically over 101 or higher, or if you develop any signs or symptoms suggestive of an infection, such as changes in your skin, a sore throat, or issues with urination or cough, let your team know immediately and seek medical attention. The second kind of blood cells in the body, in the blood are platelets. These help clot the blood, so if the platelets are low, you may be at risk of bruising or bleeding more easily. So watch out for those symptoms. And try to avoid or only take medications that may further interfere with platelet function, such as ibuprofen or naproxen, because they could interfere with platelet function and or increase risk of bleeding. With regards to the third kind of blood cells, the red blood cells that carry hemoglobin. So if the red blood cell count goes down, you may develop anemia, and that's typically followed with blood work periodically, as are the other blood counts. Patients with anemia may have fatigue, and in severe cases may have difficulty breathing or lightheadedness or dizziness. That's the first part of the talk. Again, I'd like to emphasize that most of these treatments are very well tolerated, and all these side effects that I've gone over are issues that you need to know just to watch out for, and you'll be followed very closely by your teams, and doses will be adjusted as required. So moving on to the second part of the talk about clinical trials and their role in pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors, I'll start off with a brief introduction to clinical trials and then go over a few examples of ongoing clinical trials in pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors. So clinical trials are essentially experiments to find better ways to prevent, diagnose, or treat cancer. And these are typically a very long, careful process. If we're talking about new treatment, these are typically studied in the lab initially, and then they are often also evaluated in animals. And then if there's promise and the suggestion that these are safe, then they're then brought into clinical trials in patients. These clinical trials are in several phases, typically 3 to 4 phases. So a phase one clinical trial is essentially the first in human evaluation of a new drug or a new combination of drugs. And the objective of this is to establish the safety and a right dose for the treatment. And phase two clinical trial essentially looks at this combination that was tested in phase one in a particular kind of cancer. Typically in phase one trials, because we're only looking at safety, patients of any kind of tumor type may enroll. So in phase two clinical trials, we tend to focus on one particular tumor type and look for signals of efficacy and further establish safety. If the phase two clinical trial is promising, then we go on to a phase three clinical trial where we compare this new treatment to a standard therapy. And phase four trials are often after the FDA approves based on a phase three clinical trial data. And we gather information about safety and how the drug is being used and how patients are tolerating it. And what are the benefits of being in a clinical trial and what are the risks? So I think by enrolling in a clinical trial, you may be one of the first patients to try a treatment and it may benefit you. And the experience of your being in a clinical trial, that provides information that would definitely help future cancer patients. And the clinical trials may cover a part of your care, although these rules are dependent and unique to each trial. There are also some potential risks and downsides. So because these are new drugs, sometimes unanticipated side effects could be seen that even your treating team may not anticipate. And these new treatments may not always be successful or as good as standard of treatment. And the other thing is, when you enroll in a clinical trial, I mean, there is a considerable amount of time, travel, and effort that goes into being a part of a clinical trial, and that also needs to be taken into consideration. This is a constantly evolving field, and there are clinical trials constantly opening and closing. Yesterday, when I looked up clinicaltrials.gov, which is a website managed by the NCI, National Cancer Institute, there were nearly 100 clinical trials for pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors. And there are all phases, from phase 1 through phase 3. Some of these clinical trials are asking the questions about the sequencing of therapies, whether we should start with the shots or the targeted agents or chemotherapy. And others are asking about the combination of different kinds of treatments. And there are yet others that are looking at completely novel agents as well, based on prior research. And with regards to PRRT, as Dr. O'Reilly mentioned, this is a treatment that has been tried and tested in a particular subgroup of neuroendocrine tumors that arise in the small bowel, and it's shown to be very beneficial for patients with neuroendocrine tumors starting in the small bowel. So the next kind of question is, would this therapy work for patients with neuroendocrine tumors arising in other parts of the body? So there are several trials that are looking at PRRT, peptide receptor radionuclide therapy, in pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors. For instance, there is a trial that's called LUNET that is comparing PRRT to an old treatment that called interferon in patients with neuroendocrine tumors arising in the gastrointestinal tract, including pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors. And this is just one example of several ongoing trials with this therapy. So that's about clinical trials. And to wrap up quickly, I'll move to the third part of the talk about kind of the questions for your team and what questions you should be asking. I think it's bottom line is you should ask as many questions as you have and as many questions as you want, because it helps you become better informed and manage things in a much better fashion. And there have been studies that showed that cancer patients who are well-informed about their disease and treatment options usually tend to do better and tend to have fewer side effects than those who don't. There are also other patients who do not want to know everything about their cancer. So you may want to think about how much you want to know about the cancer and things like that. To make your interaction with your physicians effective and efficient, I think going over and thinking about questions that you would like to bring up and potentially writing them down and taking that list with you to when you go see your physician, I think would be a good idea. And when you are actually at the appointment, if you at any time are having trouble understanding or following what your physician or other healthcare providers are saying, I think you should interrupt and ask them to go over things, or sometimes they may be able to draw a picture or give you an example that would be helpful. And you may want to also write, jot down notes while you're there. And most physicians and providers would be happy to also provide you with additional printed information and also direct you to resources on the web, such as those maintained by the American Cancer Society or PanCAN or cancer.net. And always make sure that you have a phone number that you could call if you have further questions or issues that you could access to. So what sort of questions should you ask? I think just general information about the kind of cancer you have, where it is, the kind of stage, and the potential implications of the diagnosis on your lifestyle and such as diet, exercise, and so on. And what symptoms to expect and how to manage them, and potential treatment options for these symptoms. And what additional tests need to be done for both for diagnosis, such as biopsies or other procedures. And what tests need to be done to completely stage the tumor. And finally, what are the treatment options? What are the different treatment options? What are the pros and cons of each option? And what would be the best fit for you? And also looking into if you need support services and what other kind of options are available to help provide support in terms of addressing your symptoms or other issues. So I think the bottom line is it's great for patients to be and family members to be proactive and take charge of their treatment, and that's always a great thing to do. I'll stop there.
Well, I'd like to thank you, Dr. Ansari, for just an excellent presentation, really outstanding and very helpful in terms of just the management of treatment side effects and also communicating with the healthcare team and all the information about clinical trials. So thank you for that. I'm sure there'll be lots of questions for you during the Q&A, so thank you. And our next speaker is Maria Petzl. Ms. Petzl is Senior Clinical Dietitian, Pancreas Surgery Program, University of Texas, MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Ms. Petzl is going to address nutrition and hydration concerns and tips. And I'm going to turn this program over to Ms. Petzl.
Thanks, Carolyn. Thank you all for joining. It's a real honor to be invited to speak today. Nutrition is definitely a hot topic for many patients and their caregivers. It can be helpful for managing side effects of treatment, disease, or surgeries. For those patients without any side effects from treatment, as Dr. Dasari was saying, most people handle these treatments quite well. So really using nutrition to help support the body and help prevent any other secondary health concerns. So our goal in general is to follow a good healthy diet with whole grains, fruits, vegetables, lean proteins, and dairies, following the same diet that's recommended for cancer prevention. For more information, I would refer you to the February 1st talk that was available through Cancer Care and is now in the archives titled Nutrition and Healthy Eating Tips During and After Cancer Treatment. Specifically with regards to neuroendocrine tumors, about a fourth of patients may experience something called carcinoid syndrome, which is characterized commonly by diarrhea and or flushing after meals. And certain foods or food-related habits may trigger these symptoms and should be avoided. And this is really a quality of life issue. So trigger foods or habits include eating large meals, eating high-fat meals, drinking alcohol, eating foods that are very spicy, eating raw tomatoes, or including foods in the diet that are high or moderate in amines. Now, what foods have amines? These are typically aged cheeses, alcohol, smoked, salted, pickled fish or meats, also fermented foods such as miso, sauerkraut, kimchi, and other things such as fish sauce and soy sauce. Foods that are moderate in amines may include dark chocolate, milk chocolate, peanuts, Brazil nuts, or coconut, but also avocado, banana, raspberries, soy foods, fava beans, and then foods with caffeine. So essentially, if you are a patient who experiences these symptoms after eating these foods, we would recommend avoiding and limiting those completely from the diet. And with time, potentially, you might be able to tolerate small amounts of those foods occasionally in the diet. Diarrhea related to carcinoid syndrome or potentially related to treatment or a surgery that was done to remove a primary tumor is not uncommon in this group. Some tips that can be used in general include eating small, frequent meals, really drinking adequate fluids, and especially focusing on fluids that are electrolyte-containing fluids. So drinks such as G2 or regular strength sports drinks that are half water diluted. Also, commercial products, electrolyte products such as Pedialyte, Cerelite, or Drip Drop. Additional strategies include increasing soluble fiber foods in the diet. Foods that are high in soluble fiber help gel the stool, and these foods include oats, banana, apple without the peel, and also citrus fruits without a lot of membrane. And then during periods of diarrhea, decreasing insoluble fiber. This is what we think of as roughage. So this is what we get from fruits and vegetables, especially with thick skins and peels, and also with whole grains. We would only want to avoid or make these adjustments when patients are having diarrhea because, of course, fruits, vegetables, and whole grains would be part of our ideal healthy diet. If diarrhea is an ongoing problem, working specifically with a dietitian who can help tailor your diet to really optimize your intake. As Dr. O'Reilly mentioned, many patients are treated with sandostatin or lanreotide, the hormonal treatments, and these can decrease the secretion of pancreatic enzymes or digestive enzymes. So it's really important to discuss with your team if you're having diarrhea or digestive symptoms and have been on these hormonal treatments for a period of months or years, potentially pancreatic enzymes would be helpful. Also, for patients who have had a pancreatic surgery as part of their treatment, pancreatic enzymes may be helpful to improve digestion. One little aside is patients who have experienced carcinoid syndrome are at risk for niacin deficiency, so it's very important to discuss that with your primary team as well. So finally, these recommendations are all general, and they may not all apply to you. So I do encourage you to ask to speak with a registered dietitian at your oncology center and out in the community, potentially looking for a certified specialist in oncology to really help guide individualized nutrition plans. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you very much, Maria. That was really wonderful and very informative, with lots of information for everybody to utilize. And always nutrition is such an important topic, and hydration as well. And our next speaker is Elizabeth Ezra. And Ms. Ezra is an oncology social worker, and she is our pancreatic cancer program coordinator at Cancer Care. Ms. Ezra is going to address Cancer Care's free psychosocial support services and programs and the role of support groups. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Ms. Ezra.
Thank you, Carolyn, and it's a pleasure to be here today. I am an oncology social worker, and I work with many people with pancreatic cancer and their loved ones. I would like to begin by speaking about the importance of creating a support network when you're diagnosed with cancer and how cancer care can be a part of that network. There are many ways that we can help. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. Cancer Care's programs include individual counseling, support groups, either over the telephone or online, education about resources and how to navigate the health care system, practical help, and some limited financial assistance, as well as chemo copay assistance. And that is all provided by licensed master's level oncology social workers and are completely free of charge. Oncology social workers are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her family and friends. They are also trained to help cancer patients and their family tackle the problems that accompany these diseases, such as the financial demands, the physical changes, social adjustments, and the psychosocial, psychological impact and care. Adjusting to and dealing with the diagnosis is an important part of the healing process. Cancer affects the whole person and the entire family. Asking for help by joining a support group or by contacting a social worker for counseling is a sign of strength. Joining a support group is a way to connect with others who are going through similar situation and have similar problems. These connections help lessen the isolation that many people with cancer experience. Support groups are a safe place where you can voice your concerns and your fears. Feeling well emotionally can help you better deal with the diagnosis and the treatment. At this time, Cancer Care does offer a pancreatic cancer telephone support group, as well as an online group for pancreatic caregivers. And we also have unique young adult groups, so definitely come to our website, www.cancercare.org, to look for these. Cancer Care can also provide some financial assistance for transportation expenses, as well as chemo co-payments. Chemo copay assistance. If you are interested in any of these services, please call our HOPE line at 1-800-813-HOPE or 4673, or again at our website at www.cancercare.org. Our website is very comprehensive, and you can find a lot of additional information on your cancer diagnosis and the treatments you need to receive. As we have learned from today's program, there's a lot of information to digest and get your arms around. Our social workers can help you understand what it means for you and your family. Your social worker can help you prioritize and actually rehearse the questions that you might want to ask to get the answers and the information that you need. Please remember that you are not alone. Cancer Care Services are there to help you. Thank you for your attention and the opportunity to talk to you today.
Oh, thank you so much, Liz. That's really wonderful. And really all the different services that people can access, I think you did a great job in describing them. And please do take advantage of them, and you can call anytime for any of them or just to check out what we can do for you. And now we have time for questions. We actually have a lot of time for questions, and I really want to thank our speakers for that. We're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible, and if we don't get to your question, I will tell you all what to do at the end of the call so you can get your questions answered. But for now, let's see, Candace, if you could explain to everybody how to queue up for questions, and we'll take as many as possible right now.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question at this time, please press star and then the number one key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. And our first question comes from Denise W. Your line is now open.
Hi, how are you? Excellent presentation. I'm a social worker and I'm also a certified holistic health counselor. I'm wondering what your feeling is as far as nutrition with juicing natural organic vegetables for these patients.
Well, thank you for that excellent question. I'm going to ask Ms. Petzl if you could address that question and to start with.
Certainly. So with patients that have GI side effects, especially things like diarrhea, where we're restricting the insoluble fiber, this would be an alternative to help get some of those great phytochemicals and vitamins and minerals from fruits and juices, from fruits and vegetables that just are not necessarily tolerated in their whole form. So I think that juicing can play a role. I think it's important to make sure that we're not filling patients up on juice and including lots of other important protein foods, et cetera. And then also really thinking about the fruit and vegetable ratio. So in a typical diet, we want to eat about twice as many servings of vegetables versus fruit. So when juicing, making sure to include good sources of vegetables and not just using fruits for those juices.
Excellent point. And does anyone else want to comment on that? Okay, cool. Thank you. Okay, our next question.
Our next question comes from the line of Thomas C. Your line is now open.
Hello. Are there some benign pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors?
Thank you. That's an excellent question. Dr. O'Reilly, could you address that?
Yeah, so thank you for that. That's an interesting one. So where the bridge between benign or non-malignant and malignant tumor begins and ends is sometimes a tricky one for very well-differentiated, very low-grade tumors, and very small tumors that look very like normal cells that don't have a lot of blood vessel involvement, a lot of cell turnover, don't have necrosis, which is sometimes a feature of more active cells. They typically have a very low potential for causing spread to other areas, particularly if they're under a certain size. But yes, this can be a subtlety in terms of how pathologists interpret it. But by definition, if we're seeing beyond the primary organ, by definition, that is a malignant tumor. And some of the older terminology that was used was rather confusing. Both the European and the American groups have tried to standardize this, so it's less confusing, but there are many different terms that are used to describe neuroendocrine cancers, and I think that also leads to a little bit of this confusion.
Excellent. Thank you. We have a question from Maria, one of our online participants. With advanced NET, do people have a symptom of pain over the body during stress? Dr. Dasari, can you address this in a general way?
So pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors could cause a lot of symptoms, but a lot of patients also do not have any symptoms. Unlikely that stress or other triggers would cause generalized body pain. But however, if there's a particular area that's of concern and it's consistently bothering you, I think you should let your team know to make sure that your cancer has been, or the patient's cancer has been staged adequately to make sure that it's not your symptoms are not related to cancer spread.
Excellent. And so related to that, are the treatments the same for recurrent NETs? So Dr. O'Reilly, could you address that?
So treatments differ when neuroendocrine cancers have returned. So typically, if it's localized and operable, that's a preferred approach as an initial step. In general, and there are exceptions here, but in general, for most well-differentiated and lower-grade neuroendocrine cancers, we do not recommend additional therapy after surgery, provided a complete removal has been done. That's in distinction to high-grade neuroendocrine cancers, which we didn't talk about so much, but these are much more active cancers. They have a high rate of cell turnover, a high propensity to have metastasis to other areas in the body. There, an operation is usually the secondary issue, and the primary treatment would be chemotherapy, and these cancers can be quite responsive to chemotherapy. So in that setting, yes, if we find out it's a high-grade malignancy, we will give chemotherapy after surgery. For recurrent disease, depending on the location of where the metastases are, and depending, again, what the volume of disease is, whether or not a person has symptoms, will dictate what would be the preferred treatment. And as we alluded to earlier in the talk, there are a number of different approaches here, all of which may be very reasonable for a given person. And part of this challenge, I think, in the field is trying to strategize what would be the best sequence of therapies for a given person over time to maximize the outcome and to use all the best tools that we have available. And a number of trials are underway are trying to address this question.
Excellent. Thank you. And we have another question from one of our online participants, Rita. Can this be passed on to my children? Should I have them screened? Dr. Dasari, could you address that?
Yeah, so pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors are, first off, very rare. And most of them are what are called sporadic. That is, there is no hereditary underlying hereditary syndrome that causes the risk to pass through generations. However, there's a small minority in whom these could be genetic, and these families are most commonly have a certain condition called MEN1 or multiple endocrine neoplasia syndrome 1. As Dr. O'Reilly mentioned in her talk, these patients and also their family members tend to have tumors in multiple endocrine glands, so very characteristic and very hard to miss. There are also much rarer syndromes, such as von Hippel-Lindau syndrome and other very rare syndromes. Bottom line is, for the overwhelming majority, it's not genetic or hereditary. There's a very small minority of patients in whom it's hereditary, and they typically have these very characteristic and unique presentations.
Well, I want to thank all of our speakers. This has been an extraordinary call. I want to thank all of you who've queued up and asked questions both on the phone and online. I want to remind you that this is a one-hour workshop, and in planning this program today, we recognize that you have many questions and many issues that go far beyond the scope of 1 hour. So I do want to first of all address, for those of you who still have questions or have questions as time goes on, who you should call. So in terms of any medically focused questions, we do recommend that you go ahead and call the National Cancer Institute at 1-800-422-6237. Again, that's 1-800-422-6237. We also have a number of pancreatic cancer organizations that we've partnered with that you also can call them as well. And for any questions regarding any emotional or financial or practical or concerns that you may have just in coping with pancreatic neuroendocrine cancer, other types of tumors as well, we'd like you to contact our cancer care social work staff here at 1-800-813-4673. Again, that's 1-800-813-4673. Most importantly, as we conclude the program today, we don't want any of you to think that you're alone in coping with a pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors or any other type of cancer. We want you to know that you're part of this community of support, and we're here to help you. And not only is Cancer Care here to help you, but there are many organizations here to help you, and you simply can call us. We're a phone call away, or you can visit us on our website. Again, I want to thank you all for participating today. This has been an amazing conference call, I have to say, and one that we hope to repeat in the near future as well. Thank you all, and I want to wish you all a very fine day.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This does conclude today's workshop, and you may all disconnect. Have a great day, everyone.